A reading from the book of 2 Kings. Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign. He reigned for 31 years in Jerusalem. He did what was right in the sight of Yahweh and walked in all the way of his father David. He did not turn aside to the right or to the left. In the 18th year of King Hosea, the king sent Shaphan, the secretary, to the house of Yahweh, saying, "Go up to the high priest Hilkiah and have him count the entire sum of the money that has been brought into the house of Yahweh, which the keepers of the threshold have collected from the people. Let it be given into the hand of the workers who have the oversight of the house of Yahweh. Let them give it to the workers who were at the house of Yahweh repairing the house, that is, to the carpenters, to the builders, to the masons, and let them use it to buy timber and quarried stone to repair the house. But no account shall be asked from them for the money that is delivered into their hand, for they deal honestly." The high priest Hilkiah said to Shaphan the secretary, "I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord." When Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, he read it. Then Shaphan the secretary came to the king and reported to the king, "Your servants have emptied out the money that was found in the house and have delivered it into the hand of the workers who have oversight of the house of Yahweh." Shaphan, the secretary, informed the king, "The priest Hilkiah has given me a book." Shaphan read it aloud to him. When the king heard the words of the book of the law, he tore his clothes. Then the king commanded his advisors, saying, "Go inquire of Yahweh for me, for the people, and for all Judah, concerning the words of this book that has been found. For great is the wrath of Yahweh that is kindled against us, because our ancestors did not obey the words of this book to do according to all that is written concerning us." So they went to the prophetess Huldah. She resided in Jerusalem in the second quarter, where they consulted her. She declared to them, "Thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, tell the man who sent you to me, thus says Yahweh, I will indeed bring disaster on this place and on its inhabitants, all the words of the book that the king of Judah has read. Because they have abandoned me and have made offerings to other gods, so that they have provoked me to anger with all the work of their hands, therefore my wrath will be kindled against this place, and it will not be quenched. But as to the king of Judah, who sent you to inquire of Yahweh, thus shall you say to him, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, regarding the words that you have heard. Because your heart was penitent, and you humbled yourself before Yahweh, when you heard how I spoke against this place and against its inhabitants, that they should become a desolation and a curse, and because you have torn your clothes and have wept before me, I also have heard you, says Yahweh. Therefore, I will gather you to your ancestors, and you shall be gathered to your grave in peace. Your eyes shall not see all the disaster that I will bring on this place." They took the message back to the king. Then the king directed that all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem should be gathered to him. The king went up to the house of Yahweh, and with him went all the people of Judah, all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the priests, the prophets, and all the people, both small and great. He read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant that had been found in the house of Yahweh. The king stood by the pillar and made a covenant before Yahweh to follow Yahweh, keeping his commandments, his decrees, and his statutes with all his heart and with all his soul, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in this book. All the people joined in the covenant. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. When the Pharisees and some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus, they noticed that some of his disciples were eating with defiled hands, that is, without washing them. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they thoroughly wash their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders. And they do not eat anything from the market unless they wash it. And there are also many other traditions that they observe, the washing of cups, pots, and bronze kettles. So the Pharisees and the scribes asked Jesus, "Why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?" Jesus said to them, "Isaiah prophesies rightly about you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines. You abandon the commandment of God and hold to human tradition.'" Then Jesus said to them, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and your mother.' And whoever speaks evil of father or mother must surely die. But you say that if anyone tells father or mother, 'Whatever support you may have had from me is korban,' that is, an offering to God, then you no longer permit doing anything for a father or mother, thus making void the word of God through your tradition that you have handed on. And you do many things like this." The Gospel of Christ.
My wife Wanda and I are big fans of the 1990s television series called The West Wing. You might have seen it. It represents a what-if scenario of what the White House might operate like if you had really solid and good people in there. We like it so much that not only did we watch all 7 series live when it was broadcast originally, you know how when the season would end with a cliffhanger in April and you had to wait all summer long to pick up the story again in September? We even bought the DVD set and we've watched that through twice now and we're on our 3rd re-watching of it. We're in season 3 now already. Really big fans of this show. And it stars Martin Sheen as the President of the United States. And one of the interesting things about this series is the writer, Aaron Sorkin, is a phenomenal screenwriter. The way that he turns phrases and has the ensemble cast do its work is amazing. And of course, he's also the one that determined what their names would be. The name of the president in The West Wing is Jed Bartlett. But Jed is his nickname. His actual first name is Josiah Bartlett. And I don't know for sure, but from what I've seen of Aaron Sorkin's work, I bet you he deliberately chose the first name Josiah Bartlett as a reflection of King Josiah that we heard about in 2 Kings chapter 22. King Josiah became the king at 8 years of age. But it wasn't until 18 years later, when he was 26, that he really started to do the thing that he was well known for. And I would suggest to you that it can be argued and has been argued, that, you know how I always said that David was the best king that Israel ever had? One could argue that Josiah was better. Because it was said of him in the reading that you heard Susan read this morning that Josiah did what was right in the sight of Yahweh and walked in all the ways of his father David. He did not turn aside to the right or to the left. Whereas, of course, King David had in the instance of his desire for Bathsheba, committing adultery and then committing murder to cover the adultery and all of that. Josiah did nothing like that. In fact, one could also argue that Josiah is the first Messiah of Israel. You see, the language of the expectation of the Messiah, or the Christ, as it says in our sign there, the reign of Christ, Christ is Greek, Messiah is Hebrew, the first talk, the first expression of this anticipation of someone that would be called the Messiah comes in the voices of the prophets Isaiah, Micah, and Hosea, who were prophesying shortly before and during the fall of the northern kingdom of Israel. That happened in 722 BCE. Those three prophets are the ones who started giving this hope of a Messiah. Now, for the northern kingdom of Israel, because they were completely obliterated by the Assyrian Empire, the story was pretty much over for them. But that messianic hope and messianic promise continued for the southern kingdom of Judah, such that these were words that the people of Judah were listening to. Now, the people of Judah managed to live longer as a nation than the northern kingdom of Israel. They lived for another 150 years before their ultimate demise at the hands of Babylon in 586. But one thing that's interesting to see about these two kingdoms, as we've talked about in the last couple of weeks, the northern kingdom of Israel had 20 kings in total, and not one of them did what was right in the sight of Yahweh. All of them had been doing what was evil. Their kings were causing the people to sin, and that was partly the reason for why their demise came so soon. Now, even though the kingdom of Judah lasted 150 years longer, it's interesting that they too had 20 monarchs. They just happened to have longer reigns than the kings of Israel did. And I say 20 monarchs because they also had one queen. Athaliah was in there as well. But after the fall of Israel, we continued on seeing the kings of Judah reigning. And when you get to the end of the story of Judah, you find that not only did they have 20 kings, but they actually did have kings who did what was right in the sight of Yahweh. Now, it turns out to be quite a minority. Only 6 of their kings did what was right in the sight of Yahweh. There were 2 others who started out doing what was right, but by the time they get to the second half of their life, they had abandoned the ways of Yahweh, so they kind of don't count because they didn't finish well. So 6. Still not a great percentage, but nevertheless, that many more. During the time that Israel fell in 722, there was a righteous king called Hezekiah who was reigning at the time. But then, after him, came 2 more kings, one of them named Manasseh, who reigned for 55 years. And for the kingdom of Judah, was the worst king of all. And then his son Amon reigned for 2 years after that. And then his son Josiah came to the throne at age 8, and this was about 640 BCE. When Josiah took the throne, the kingdom of Judah, indeed, even if you counted up all of the different kings in both the kingdoms, the range of time in which Judah dealt with a king that was leading them astray was the longest block of time ever. 57 years of first Manasseh and then Amon doing what was evil in the sight of the Lord. A generation in ancient Israel is 40 years long. And so this is like a generation and a half where all that Judah knew was some king leading them away from the proper worship and honor of Yahweh. It was into this context that Josiah took the throne at age 8. Now, that messianic promise that had been given about 80 years earlier started to be recalled by the people once Josiah started doing his thing. So in his 18th year of his reign, as we heard about in this reading, when he was 26 years old, he was able to start doing something. And part of the reason for that is Assyria was still a world power at the time. And even though Assyria did not control Judah, its influence nevertheless required that they kind of tread carefully. But there was a change in leadership there, which allowed Josiah to start taking some steps. And so one of the things that he did was he recognized that even though he had never known a king who was following in the ways of Yahweh, he knew that the temple in the middle of Jerusalem was actually to honor the God of Israel, and it had fallen into disrepair because Manasseh and Amon weren't interested in doing much with it. And so they had had a means by which they would take collections for the upkeep of the temple, kind of like a offering box at the entry. And so Josiah said, you know what, we got to fix this. So he told his people, go ahead, collect up the money that's been collected and give it to the artisans, the craftsmen, the carpenters, the stonemasons, all those guys. Just give them that money, tell them to go buy the stuff they need, and let's make this temple look good. And don't even ask them for receipts, okay? We're just going to trust them. Let's just get this job done, get the temple back to where it should be. And so they did. And as time progressed, Josiah sent his secretary, Shaphan, to go check on the work. So Shaphan gets there and sees that things are coming along quite well. But then the high priest Hilkiah comes up to him and says, Shaphan, you should know, I found this. This is the book of the law of Yahweh. Now it says book, it really was a scroll, just so you know, we've got the image right. But he gives this to Shaphan, and Shaphan opens it up and reads it, and then he goes, I got to get this to the king. And so Shaphan goes back to King Josiah, tells him things are going well on as far as the work of the temple is concerned, but then he also said, there's one more thing, Hilkiah gave me this book of the law of Yahweh. And so then Shaphan opened it and read it to King Josiah. And as Josiah was reading, or hearing rather, the words of the book of the law, he tore his garments in grief, in frustration, in anger, in remorse. Because what he was likely hearing were the words of what would be the core of the book of Deuteronomy. It had been put aside, perhaps hidden. If Manasseh and Amon for 57 years weren't interested in the law of Yahweh, then that book, that scroll just got put away somewhere and forgotten about to collect dust. And Josiah didn't even know that it existed. When he heard the warnings in it, the promises and the warnings, the promise, if you do what is right and follow me, Yahweh says, then things will go well with you and your crops will grow and you'll be successful. But if you do what is wrong and do not follow the words of this law, then bad things are going to happen to you. And when Josiah heard those words, that was the reason why he tore his garments. And he realized, okay, we've really been messing this up. Something's got to change. So he says to his advisors, go talk to a prophet, somebody who can hear the voice of Yahweh. I want to find out what God has to say about this. And so they find the prophetess Huldah. We mention her in one of our Eucharistic prayers, actually. And she says basically two things. Tell the king, yep, the bad stuff that is contained in that book is going to happen to Judah because of its wickedness. Absolutely it will. However, for your sake, because you have humbled yourself before me, and because you have had remorse, and because you want to see things change, this will not happen during your lifetime. You are not going to see it. And so with Josiah hearing those words, he said, all right, things have to change now. And from that point on, he began a whole set of reforms that were all about getting the nation of Judah back on track with Yahweh. The temple was fixed up. The sacrificial system was put back into place. They started following the Ten Commandments. They started obeying the 613 commands of the Torah. They started doing things the way that God said it was supposed to happen. And Judah was put back on track when it came to their observation of Yahweh as their God. And these are all the things a Messiah would do. And so, in all likelihood, Josiah was being perceived as perhaps this one that had been talked about. Unfortunately, he was killed in battle, pierced by arrows. That's how he died, which is what caused the prophet Zechariah in chapter 12 to talk about how they looked upon him who had been pierced, which will later be attributed to Jesus. But originally was attributed to Josiah, this great king who had died. Unfortunately, for all of the good that Josiah did, the four kings that followed him just put it all aside again. One king reigned for 3 months, then another one for 11 years, and a third one for 3 months, then the last one, Zedekiah, for 11 years, and he was the one who suffered defeat at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. And Judah was no more taken into exile, which we'll talk about next week. What happens? What happened? Why would such things take place? After such a great king, one who instituted these reforms and brought the people's attention back to Yahweh, who himself took it upon himself to make sure it happened. As we read in the chapter 23 here, he stood at the entrance to the temple and had all the people gather, and he read to them the law and said, everybody, this is how we're supposed to be living, and we haven't done it for over 60 years. Today is going to be a change. I'm renewing this covenant with Yahweh, and all the people renewed it with him. Even after that, they departed from following as they should. I would suggest to you that what we see reflected in this history of Israel, that we read about in weeks past, how Israel wasn't following the right way. Now we're reading about how Judah struggled to follow the right way, only six kings doing the right thing. What we are seeing is not an account for how bad the people of Israel were, but really a microcosm of our tendencies as human beings to so easily depart from what it is that God would really have us to do. We even see that reflected in the gospel reading today, where the Pharisees and the scribes come up to Jesus, and because his disciples start eating without washing their hands first, which is part of the tradition of the elders, they make a federal case of it and go, like, how come your disciples aren't washing their hands before? Well, you know, that's what we're supposed to do. This is what the traditions of the elders are. And Jesus' response to them is to say, the prophet Isaiah was right when he said of you guys, this people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Now, make no mistake, Isaiah was not thinking about the Pharisees and scribes 700 years after he said those words, but he was talking about the characteristics of how people tend to move. The Pharisees and the scribes were interested in people doing the right thing because they know their history, and it was because they didn't follow the law of God that they ended up having difficulty, and so now they're wanting to make sure that people do the right thing. And the traditions of the elders were inspired by that which was already contained in the law, but it went further and soon became the thing itself. And Jesus' point to the Pharisees was, you're so focused on the washing of the hands, you're missing the point behind the entire law. It has to do with who we are supposed to be. This is a recurring pattern. We can go back to the book of Judges, Judges chapter 8. Gideon was one of the great judges that defended the collection of tribes in that period of time, given one military victory after another. And at the end of one of his great victories, the people wanted to give him a tribute. And he said, no, I don't want your money. That's not the idea. But if you have to give something, let me take your gold and I'll do something with it. And so he took their gold, melted it down, and made it into an ephod. An ephod is kind of like a breastplate. The high priests would wear an ephod. And Gideon's intention with this was that this ephod would be a commemorative piece of the great victories Yahweh had given to Israel during his time. But it didn't take long for the Israelites to begin to worship the thing. And it became an idol. It became something that they needed to get rid of because they started worshiping the thing instead of the one who had given them the victory. Similarly, in Hezekiah's day, this is Josiah's great-grandfather, who started his reign 6 years before the northern kingdom of Israel fell. He started instituting reforms back then as well, and he started getting rid of idols that were being worshipped by the people of Judah and so on. And one of the things he had to get rid of was the bronze serpent that Moses had constructed. Do you remember that story? Before the Israelites come to the promised land, they're wandering around in the wilderness, and then they're grumbling against Yahweh and grumbling against Moses. And so it says that fiery serpents, venomous snakes, came into the camp, started biting people, and people were dying. And they're crying out to Yahweh. And so Yahweh tells Moses, look, what you got to do is make a serpent out of bronze and put it on a pole and stand it up in front of everybody. And everybody who looks at the serpent will be healed. And that's what's happened. Those who had were bitten did not die from their bites, and the snakes left, and this is a good thing. Well, evidently, the people of Israel held on to this thing. They kept it in Jerusalem somewhere. They held on to it for years, decades, centuries, actually, and they ended up giving it a name. Nehushtan is what it was called. Hezekiah had to get rid of this thing, because rather than seeing it as that sign of deliverance that Yahweh had provided, they personified it and named it and began to give offerings to it. It became an idol. This thing that Yahweh told Moses to make, the people turned into an idol, and Hezekiah had to get rid of it. The intention for it existing was absolutely godly and good, but it became something else. Josiah, in his day, had to deal with how Israel, well, Judah, really, was doing the same kind of thing. Jesus, in his day, had to deal with the Pharisees and the scribes who had the tradition of the elders become the thing that was so important, rather than what was behind all of it. So much so that he said in that passage that they had this fine way of not fulfilling the law, because the law says, honor your father and mother, which back then means that when your parents become old and can't work for themselves anymore, you take care of them. Just like they took care of you when you were a kid, you take care of them when they're older. But the tradition of the elders allowed people to show their piety and gain favor of Yahweh by devoting a certain amount of their wealth to God somehow, either giving it to the temple or to whatever. But the point is, this wealth could be set aside for the purposes of Yahweh. And some people were sloughing off on their duties to honor their father and mother by saying, "Sorry, Dad, this money is devoted to God because I'm so pious. And so the money I would have had to support you and Mom, I can't do it. Sorry, you got to fend for yourself." And Jesus is saying, "What are you, stupid? How can an expression of piety become something that precludes the actual being the kind of people you're supposed to be? The point isn't to have a competition as to who's the most pious or who can do their sacrifices the best. But it's to be the people that you're intended to be with all of this." And that's the thing, that's the challenge that we ought to remind ourselves about today on this Sunday that commemorates the reign of Christ. Because I would suggest to you that the reign of Christ coming at the end of the liturgical year, causing us to think about the promise of the return of the Messiah, the fact that Jesus would come again, that whole language around that whole thing, that too can inadvertently become a thing that we focus on rather than the people we are meant to be as ones who hope in that. And what do I mean by that? Well, when we talk about the reign of Christ, the picture that usually comes is the second coming, Jesus returning, and he puts all things right. He fixes everything. Like, automatically, suddenly people are doing the right thing, and swords are built, made into plowshares, and the lion lies down with the lamb, and we have peace and harmony and everything. And we can often be tempted to think that, oh man, once that day comes, it'll be lovely. Jesus, through his entire teaching, in talking about the characteristics of the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of God, is saying, that's what we are to do now. That is our task now. These are the qualities we are to display. This is the kind of people we are supposed to be now. We ought not to wait or throw up our hands in despair and just kind of go, what's the use? Let's just wait till Jesus comes back and makes it better. No, we're supposed to be the people that reflect the kind of thing we expect to see when the reign of Christ is realized. Now, what exactly is that going to look like? What day is that? Nobody has a clue. But until then, that's what we are to be. And so the challenge for us, in light of the example of Josiah, in these recurring patterns that we see in ancient Israel, the Pharisees and all, what we are seeing is not reason to get down on ancient Israel, but to see it as a cautionary tale of our tendency of human beings to see a thing and elevate its importance instead of the people we are to be in light of what these things are talking about and what they're pointing to. And so this morning, my encouragement to you is to think along those lines. What kind of person are we meant to be? Are we supposed to be people who are good at liturgy? And especially for us in a mainline church, we have all sorts of liturgical things. All sorts of stuff and rules that come with it. Like, you know, you're supposed to light this candle first before you light that candle. And then this candle gets snuffed out first before that one. Nothing wrong with those rules. But if we start making the focus of our work as being how well we can make Sunday happen, I would suggest we're probably missing the point of why we gather for worship in the first place. The tools of liturgy are meant to be helpful to us to become who we're supposed to be. The point isn't for us to be good at it, but to be the good people that God desires, that Jesus talks about, who gives us the picture of the world as it ought to be and calls us to be ones who are seeking to do exactly that in the world as it is now. And so on this last Sunday of the liturgical year, before we step into Advent and start looking forward to Jesus' arrival and his birth, let us think of this consummation of the ages and understand that our part now is to be giving a glimpse of what that day will look like whenever it comes and whatever it ultimately appear to be, and exhibit those qualities now. That's what it's all about, and that's who we are to be. So let's be about being those kinds of people. Amen.